Sorry. Good morning. Good morning, Lucien. How are you today?
Sputtering through game week 21. I have zero players tonight, and I just want Wolves to win. That's all I need.
Okay, well, let's get right into a formal intro, shall we? This is Net That Hall review show for game week 21, which means we are in the middle of... Well, game week 21 is almost over. One game to play. We're not even in the middle of the two game weeks yet, even though it's been an eternity. And then some since this game week started. I am Gabe at FPL Lens on X. I'm joined here by Lucien at teacher_FPL. You are watching Net That Haul. It's been a while for me, so I'm a little bit rusty. We got some people in the chat. We'll say hello to them momentarily. But we do want to go right into the games, the matches of the week, because obviously in a game week that's so long, and we're trying to keep this under an hour, of course, in a game week that is so long, it's easy to forget what happened, say, Chelsea Fulham or Burnley Luton. And we may not even care, but we're going to go over them anyway, just to give everyone their due a little bit of airtime. Thanks for joining us in the chat. We are going to try to kind of fly through this. We may have time for questions, depends on how quickly we go, so feel free to drop them in there. We'll get to them at the end. Let's get right into it, shall we, Lucien? I won't even ask how your game week is going. I haven't really checked. I still haven't checked rank. I think I'm doing all right. There are points. There are some others that didn't get points. Let's go right into Burnley Luton. Burnley won, Luton won. Burnley with an XG of 1.1 and Luton with 0.95. So quite even there in terms of those stats. Luton with a lot more possession than Burnley, which I thought was really surprising. But let's get into your notes. What did you see in this one?
Well, the slide. Well, okay. First of all, a very big thank you to Chris. Yes, up the Wolves. Thanks for that. Yes. And so in terms of Burnley Luton, what the slide said obviously highlighted the magnificent Odobert, the one midfielder that none of us will ever get. But still, for Burnley, at least he has officially taken over the reins from the injured Koliosho. And well, I think the nice thing about Odobert, at least for people considering him on a wild card over someone like Pedro Neto, is that Odobert is a player that lasts 90 minutes. Because even though Kompany can make substitutions, he ended up on the right side and he still created chances for himself. Now, Luton is a little bit more consistent in the sense that, well, Alfie Doughty, right? For better or worse, Alfie Doughty is up there. The real question is whether Alfie Doughty is actually involved. The idea here is that, well, with Luton, we know that their style is consistent, their weaknesses are consistent, and now, really, the focus is on the double game week on the horizon for Luton, especially because, you know, that double against Liverpool, right? And I think the real question is, will we expect Doughty to come up with some sort of set piece points or perhaps, you know, this sort of last minute dodgy assist points where he puts a cross in and you know, the Burnley goalkeeper gets impeded by Adebayo. But really, the real story behind Luton's recent knack for scoring late goals is the fact that they start with Adebayo, and your slides rightly point this out. But the idea here is that as the game goes on, Rob Edwards, he brings on different types of target men into the box. And so you have Carlton Morris in there, you've got, you know, Ogbeni, and yeah, there are plenty of different types of targets that eventually build towards this ascendancy. So it's okay for Luton to concede the first goal because they'll eventually get something back. At least you'll trust that they'll get something back, whether home or away. And that's all I have, really, in terms of important things.
Yeah, I mean, I think Odobert stood out to me on the slide. We won't spend too much time on this one, of course. But I did want to mention that because I thought that was a kind of a shrewd call on Odobert kind of resolving Burnley's penetration issues to an extent. He does it better than anybody. And then the Doughty, I mean, Doughty's just going to, like, if, I mean, play Doughty versus teams that are weak against crosses, right? Doughty's just going to cross the ball all game long, cross and cross, corners and crosses. So, I mean, you know, you're getting 14 crosses a game, you know, there's like a way to target that, but I don't think Doughty is a pick per se overall. I know a lot of people are getting excited about him, but I think that with what we're seeing, especially in defense, and we'll talk more about this on the matchup show on Wednesday, but there's kind of like this defensive template forming, right? And you're looking at and maybe Chilwell starting to enter that, but you're looking at Trent because he'll be healthy soon. Livermento now that if that move gets completed, and you have some other guys. So we'll get some more on that. I think on Wednesday, as we can get to the next match here. And the next one is Chelsea Fulham. Chelsea won, Fulham nothing. I was surprised a little bit by this. I mean, Chelsea did generate an XG of 2.19 compared to Fulham 0.86. And I was reading your notes on this match regarding how certain things didn't come to the fray for Fulham, because they didn't have much going forward. Chelsea kind of like dominated on that front. What did you see?
Well, I think the first thing that we anticipated was Nkunku basically holding the entire attack together like glue. And with his shoulder injury, they basically shifted all their attack to the right side with Palmer majority on the ball. It's kind of like Chelsea in game week 14, when Palmer had to drop deep from his number 10 position and dictate play from the right. So the difference here is that Sterling from the left flank drifted all the way to the right-hand side. And that was basically how Chelsea won their penalty on the stroke of halftime. I would say, though, that the encouraging thing about Chelsea is that despite going 1-0 up, they actually generated more XG than Fulham at home in the second half. So perhaps it's good news that, yes, Palmer only had a single return here, but most of Chelsea's forwards still eventually had chances to extend their lead, which is kind of what we want from a Chelsea game at home, right? Given their fixtures moving forward. I do want to give a quick note on Fulham as well, because, well, I think this is arguably the first team, I would say, besides Aston Villa and Man City statistically, that I can safely say behave very, very differently at home compared to away. So I hope, Colm Bugler, that's a fair assessment. And really, the wing threat is always going to be there. Robinson, Willian, whatever you have. And the key thing here is that Fulham need two João Palhinhas. They just need two of them and they'll solve all their issues. If they can sign a João Palhinha this transfer window, Fulham will solve all their problems, because neither Kearney nor Harrison Reed is the solution defensively. That's basically what Chelsea exploited here. So, yeah, it's a catch-22, because Kearney's fantastic in attack. He just has his own flaws defensively, exactly the same as Harrison Reed. So, yeah, we'll just have that in transition for now.
So yeah, I'm not up to date on the severity of injuries or anything like that. And I did, when I, at the time I wrote the slide, Nkunku, I guess, hadn't suffered that shoulder injury, or I didn't know about it yet. But I guess I'm wondering, if Nkunku is still out, are we back to that Chelsea that are really just not very good in open play and unable to form any kind of cohesion? Because, I mean, I think obviously with Nkunku, everything changes. And having Nkunku and Palmer together, I think, can be a formidable attack that we'll be targeting moving forward. But without Nkunku, is it just kind of ignore Chelsea until Nkunku? Or are you thinking of something else?
Yeah, I mean, given the choices at 5 million, I do feel that Cole Palmer on penalty duties, at least we know for sure that Chelsea have a variety of options that know how to fall down in the box. I mean, you think of Chelsea as a team that has a plan A, a plan B, and a plan C. So if their plan A doesn't work because Nkunku is injured, at least we know that Cole Palmer is going to be like involved with the majority of their plan B creatively. So that's kind of what we want in an FPL asset that's under 6 million anyway. You know, as long as he's going to be involved and we know that he's going to be reliably within the chances somewhere, then yeah, you know, I'm more than happy to just keep him in the team. But yeah, additional investment, we just probably have to hold off until we see Ben Chilwell or Enzo Fernandez do something on the left.
Right, right. And yeah, Black Screen obviously mentions Palmer's a must pick, surely. I mean, yeah, he's a premium pick in sheep's clothing. So I mean, get Palmer in and set and forget kind of deal. Pardon me. Let's just say before we move on to the next match, we just have a few people in the chat. So I want to say hi to them while we're here. We got Blue Danube Joe. How's it going, Joe? Comb, our resident Fulham fan. Buenos nachos. For Comb, Black Screen is always eager to go when we get started here. Nice to see Black Screen around. We got some Chris who says, up the Wolves for you, right? CK Lowe is in the house too. Good evening. You want to give this one a shot?
I wish. I want to learn Russian.
I'd love to learn Russian as well. I hear it's phonetic, so it shouldn't be too difficult to learn, but I don't speak Russian, so do let us know what the like in our alphabet so we can pronounce that. I know Nima stopped by. There he is. There's Nima stopping in. So long till game week 22. Still, yes, the wait is eternal. It's like purgatory. We have FPL Maddie Winalot. Hi, lads. First time joining you live. Hope you're both well. We are both well. Thank you, Maddie. Good to see you in the chat. I think that covers everyone for now. We have 13 people watching live. Do smash that like as we get into the next fixture here. And this one's obviously like everyone's going to be really interested in this one. The next one is Newcastle 2, Manchester City in a resurgent with exactly 3 XG at the end of the game. Newcastle 1.3 XG. Manchester City a whopping 73% possession compared to obviously Newcastle's 27%. City 27 shots compared to Newcastle's 12. Of those 27, 11 were on target. And so on and so forth. The stats really favor City here. But in terms of this one, did you see that kind of dominance that the stats are indicating? Or what did you see here?
Well, the 50-50 call was really dependent on whether Newcastle's high-pressure system would pay off, right? And Joe Linton used to be a key part of this. So with Joe Linton injured, unfortunately, they had to play long stuff at left central mid. And Lewis Miley on the right. So, I mean, Longstaff did a job, but I think it's nice to see that Alexander Isak himself at centre forward was also pulling his weight, pressing the left side. I think, though, that whatever happens with Newcastle, whether they dominate the ball or not, everything still flows down the left. Everything still goes through Anthony Gordon, and we really couldn't give a hoot whether Miguel Almiron goes to Saudi Arabia or not. Really. I mean, at the moment, I think all I can say really is that Anthony Gordon and Alexander Isak on that left side, they just have this knack of doing that whole cut in and shoot thing, right? But I mean, I think the real question really for FPL purposes is to ask ourselves, right? If we had 5 midfielders to pick, yes, budget is not an issue right now, but we are still trying to pick premium players alongside budget picks. So if Cole Palmer is your 5th midfielder, is Anthony Gordon going to be your 4th? Because we're going to see competition from Arsenal mids and Jared Bowen now that he's fit, as well as a whole, you know, selection of other players like Kevin De Bruyne and eventually Mohamed Salah when he's fit. So that's the real conundrum there, whether you can actually fit Anthony Gordon in your team. So do you want to comment on Newcastle before I do my spiel on Man City? Because I think we have 9 matches to cover, so we've got a little bit of extra time today.
Yeah, 9 matches, and this is definitely one that we won't rush. We can rush through so many of the other ones, but yeah. So in terms of Newcastle, I mean, I think I've had Anthony Gordon, I think, since like game week 5 or something really early on. So he's a season keeper for me. I bought him at 5.6 million. So I mean, Anthony Gordon and Cole Palmer are, that they are, for me, in my view, they're equal assets. They're just as valuable, one as the other. The only thing, Cole Palmer might have the edge because of penalties, But then again, we don't know if he keeps penalties when Nkunku comes in or if Nkunku takes penalties. That's an unknown right now. And then the other thing I'd say is I trust Newcastle's attack more than I trust Chelsea's attack. So I think that balance, for me, it balances them out in terms of assets. And if Palmer is a must, then for me, Gordon is a must. And then you're left with three midfield spots. De Bruyne could make a claim for one of those for sure, but isn't yet. Right now, many people have Saka, which we can talk about soon. But I think those three spots, and especially while Salah is out, are really that there's a lot of kind of excitement, at least for me, and with those three spots. You can go, if you want Jota, obviously you're banging. You can go Foden, who has a great matchup against Burnley this week. So there are different ways to go there, and I think that will be how we differentiate. But in terms of Newcastle's high press, it just doesn't work without Joe Ellington. No, like, Longstaff doesn't block lanes the way Joe Ellington does, and Longstaff doesn't funnel the player the way Joe Ellington does. Joe Ellington can trap the player either with Bruno Guimarães on his right, or even Anthony Gordon himself, because he's so mobile and he works so hard on that left hand side. And Longstaff is a little bit less intentional, I would say, in his press, and he's also less intense in his press. When Longstaff presses, it's not stressful, is it? It's almost like, okay, that it's Longstaff, we can pass around him. And certainly in the case for Manchester City, I thought they could. I think if with Trippier leaving, I think what we'll get is, rather than passes penetrating lines from that right hand side, it'll be more dribbles. Because I think Livermento is more about speed and getting into the spaces himself, whereas Trippier is more about deliveries. So that'll be something to watch. That'll be a dynamic to watch as well. But go ahead, go into Manchester City, and what are you telling? You know, Joe here says he captained Foden this game week. I didn't think that was a terrible captain choice if Haaland was out. But what did you see?
I think, well, honestly, if the only mistake you would have made captaining a Man City player is if you captain Julian Alvarez. Everyone else is fine, because Julian Alvarez is basically doing the donkey work right now. It's basically, long story short, Julian Alvarez pulls out wide and everyone fills in his space. So a lot of Man City's first half looked extremely constipated because Julian Alvarez would drag Newcastle's centre-backs out wide. And so there would be this space in the middle. And the unfortunate thing was that Bernardo, Doku even, and Foden would all cram into that central space exactly when Newcastle wanted them. The reason they wanted Longstaff and Miley to play alongside Bruno Guimarães is to literally match City's attacking midfielders 3v3. They anticipated this the whole time, and it was the wide options that came into play. So in the first half, in the first half, they had Walker extremely wide on the right side and they kept Gvardiol back. And then in the second half, when they brought Kevin De Bruyne on, Gvardiol was the one pushing all the way down the left-hand side. Really, really advanced stuff. And I do foresee, without Haaland at the moment, Man City will have one fullback extremely high up. That one I can at the very least say. The question is, who is going to be operating between the lines? Because, well, when Kevin De Bruyne does it, his passing range is so much more expansive compared to Foden's or Alvarez's or even Bernardo Silva's, arguably. So, I mean, it's difficult to say because Kevin De Bruyne only had 20-odd minutes. But at least we know that his intention is there. The moment he gets the ball between the lines, because Kovacic is the one feeding him the ball, he looks up and he instantly sees everybody. It's not just about Alvarez ahead of him. It's not just about the wide options on the right. He sees Oscar Bob on the left, and that through ball to him is miraculous. No mistake. I mean, for me, the idea here is that given all the data that Man City have put up, right, we've got to make a very important decision right now. Do we believe that Man City will consistently produce brilliant things from this game week on? Or will they just coast and win games with their plan A and not needing to do anything brilliant? Because for me, If you feel that Man City are going to beat teams 3-4, 5-0, you hop into Kevin De Bruyne right now. But if you think they're going to play it practical and win, like, you know, in this case, 3-2, needing really late goals from a Kevin De Bruyne show, then you're better off sticking with Foden for now and waiting for Kevin De Bruyne to regularly play 90 minutes before you move.
So, given their upcoming schedule, what do you think is more realistic? How will they be approaching these games?
I think, well, this is purely speculation. I think Julian Alvarez will be dropped really soon. It's just a matter of who takes his place. And at the same time, of course, this fully depends on Haaland's fitness. But I do foresee Kevin De Bruyne getting a cameo against Burnley, and then he'll get 90 minutes after that. I just don't know how much damage he'll do. Because, I mean, the question is, does Man City actually need Kevin De Bruyne against Burnley? I would highly doubt it. Because their wide options perfectly play around Burnley's game. And if Bernardo Silva and Foden, you know, if they do the damage early in the first half, then there's absolutely no need for KDB to come on. So
So
that's
I
what.
guess I would flip the question and I would ask, does Kevin De Bruyne need Burnley?
Don't really see it. I mean,
Match fitness, rhythm, start implementing maybe some new passing patterns like you mentioned with that range of passing he has. I mean, he has, yeah, it's interesting. Like Foden, Alvarez, all these kind of players, they're all very vertical, right? Whereas Kevin De Bruyne really opens up the width of the field. But the difference, I guess, the added element De Bruyne has that Bernardo Silva doesn't have is the distance of the passes, right? He's much better at those long diagonals than Bernardo Silva, and that's why he's so complete. Well, does he need Burnley to kind of come to you know get in? He's going to face a kind of a packed midfield. It would be, but not too, I guess, skilled midfield. But it'll be packed in there. Burnley packed that central mid area. So maybe it's a good game for him to kind of develop the game speed and game rhythm. And some people might say that he just did that against Newcastle. And I would say, like, hold your horses on 20 minutes on what happened results in 20 minutes. It takes time for a player to develop that. I think Burnley could be a good opportunity, but maybe it's a good opportunity to rest given the upcoming schedule as well. So, just some uncertainty there.
Yeah, so it comes down to risk appetite, right? I mean, this is one of those real scenarios where you're not surprised if he gets the tail end of the 30 minutes again, and you will not be surprised if he gets the opening 60 minutes.
Right.
Either way, right? So I think the safest way to approach this is to assume that he will get an assist, maybe 1 to 2 bonus. And the question is, can you engineer a move that beats that? You know? If you're willing to sell somebody for him, I think that's the real question.
I see, that makes sense. Let's see. I'm just looking at comments here. Maddie says Almiron, Trippier, Wilson, all getting interest for moves away from Newcastle, and Newcastle have to sell so they don't breach for overspending. That's true, and I would say that Newcastle are also that they also need depth because of the injuries that they've suffered this season. So that'll be a tough thing. Like if they do have to sell these players and their depth suffers, just kind of watch for them developing, as a team, see if they drop off or maybe with players like Harvey Barnes fit. Maybe he's not fit yet. I'm not saying he's fit, but when he does come fit, maybe next month or something like that, they could be a resurgence as well. We'll move on to the next match here. Hold on, I went away from the page. All right, here we go. Next one was Everton Villa nil nil. Everton 1.2 XG, Villa 1.26 XG. I mean, Villa away. They are anything. They are consistent when they are away from home. And we have to, like, I know there were some Ollie Watkins captain shouts. We have to, like, at some point just kind of accept the fact that Villa away are not certainly not captaincy shouts, and likely even just bench players when they're away. How do you see this one?
I'm going to start with the simple stuff first. We'll open with Everton because surprisingly they benched McNeil. That's kind of like planning out the window for us because McNeil has been such an important mainstay, right? So the reason McNeil was benched, number one is because of Danjuma. And secondly, because, well, Doucouré is back. Abdoulaye Doucouré is back. So that's another contender in there if you want a genuine goal-scoring midfielder. Personally, I'm still not convinced that Anthony Gordon's over his hamstring injury. I did not see any form of rest for the guy. So if I were to pick like 50-50, right, between Newcastle's semi-depleted squad and Everton, if they do come back, right? With a good schedule, I definitely consider Abdoulaye Doucouré because, like, doesn't matter who plays on the flanks, Abdoulaye Doucouré fills in the space. That's a given. And man, was he good in transition. Everton do not need majority of the ball. They are just so good in transition right now. And I think the idea is that Jack Harrison has this knack of finding runners behind players, whether it's McNeil, Doucouré, DCL even. Yeah, he's just able to find all these players. So I think that's Everton in a nutshell right now for the far future. Okay, Villa. Let's talk about Villa because, well, they've looked so good, right? They've beaten Arsenal, they've beaten Man City, and then suddenly they come up short against all these teams. Fine, they don't have title credentials, but the idea here is that they were so good because they have a plan A, they have a plan B, right? They've got different wide options on the right side. And now they even have a plan C because they can play Tielemans out wide. But the missing ingredient here, especially given that Alex Moreno had a goal 50-50 chalked off, is that they're missing Jacob Ramsey. The missing secret ingredient here is that half space run that they dominate so well at home. No matter what combination they play out wide on the right side, they can have Bailey and Diaby, but if they don't have the finishing, then there's no point. They can play Tielemans, shift him over to the left, John McGinn goes up the right side, but if they don't dominate the half spaces, you just don't have a guy in good shooting positions. The difference here is that at home, Douglas Luiz pushes all the way forward. He overloads the half spaces out wide. You can see in the 90th minute, Douglas Luiz would be the one just outside the edge of the box with multiple options in there. And that is the biggest difference between Villa away and at home at the moment. Of course, I would happily take any feedback from Craig, Man on Pod, once you watch this. But yes, that is what I observe of Villa at the moment.
So where is Ramsey? Why was he not in the side?
That I did not research. I just know that
he's not injured. I thought it was strange for Emery to go with. I mean, he went with McGinn on the left, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep, he did go. He started with McGinn on the left. He brought Tielemans on, put him on the left, and McGinn went to the right.
Yeah, I find this is why like Villa can get difficult. And I mean, at the same time, it keeps them unpredictable. And that's why part of the reason why Emery's doing such a great job. But for FPL assets, I think they can often be unpredictable because you don't know, is it going to be the 4-4-2? Is it going to be a 4-2-2-2? Is it going to be some wide players? Is Ramsey going to be wide? And I think the Villa that we've become accustomed to over the past couple of seasons, where they really focus on that left side of the for creativity, I think that left side, and again, Craig can correct us if he sees it differently, but that left side is dependent on Ramsey. Like he changes that left side and he brings Moreno in. Moreno had a, like you said, had a good game, but having Ramsey there brings Moreno into the play, and it links like Moreno, Ramsey, and it even makes Watkins a better asset. But I haven't seen, like, Ramsey's not, it wasn't even in the squad for this one. So I haven't seen any kind of, I haven't been able to predict the pattern. We'll ask Craig offline. I don't think he's on the show this week, but we'll ask him offline, see if we can bring it back to the main show on Wednesday when we do find out. Okay, next one. Next one. Yes, Manchester United 2, Tottenham 2. Interesting one here. Manchester United 2 goals on 0.75 XG and Tottenham 2 goals on 1.23 XG. I mean all the stats kind of favor Tottenham here. I don't know if let's see. I guess Manchester United committed more fouls, but other than that, it was kind of all Tottenham and but again, both teams kind of dysfunctional, missing some key players. I don't remember what I let's see what I wrote about him. I know I did like Rashford in this one. I highlighted
Ish,
Rashford.
ish, a little
And
bit.
yeah, I highlighted him as like the best zone that like the flanks for Rashford and Garnacho. He was in addition to Richarlison one of the my top picks for this one, but I don't feel really like there was anything systemic that led to Rashford doing anything. So it feels like almost a results based the getting it right just based on results and not based on patterns. But why don't you tell us what you saw here?
Oh, I think the first thing we have to admit is that Man United, not to say deserve their two goals. Well, I think the players, Højlund and Rashford, was it? They deserve their two goals, for sure. I mean, their finishes were fantastic. And the idea here is that Man United, right? First things first, they are not a competitive team in the 23-24 season. So when you are not a competitive team, you are reliant on these little moments just to take the lead against decent sides like Spurs. And you can tell already, right? The first goal itself, the moment Rashford runs into three players, you ask yourself, you draw all that space, where is the free man? And instead of looking for Garnacho on the right side, he backheels for Højlund in the exact same space in the box. But Højlund does so well to, blast that shot into the near post top corner that, United take the lead. So it is that type of goal that United have to subscribe to if you see United getting results. Because, United have just set such a high bar for themselves that I think no stats can ever summarize Man United at all this season because they will continue to put up inconsistent stats. Their system is never consistent. I mean, their two central midfielders were, no, three central midfielders were Eriksen, Maynou, and McTominay, I think. No, I don't even know whether McTominay started, but that's how they do it. I mean, oh, it's just so difficult to predict Man United because they react to how Spurs play. I think the only thing I can positively say about Man United is that they react to individual situations well. Even though the free man is there, right? Like a very good example was how Spurs committed both fullbacks forward. And so in this particular case, Pedro Porro was actually very disciplined on the right-hand side because he was very aware of Rashford. So every time Rashford had the ball, Pedro Porro was at least within the vicinity to defend. But Destiny Udogie was extremely out of position. But in no circumstance did Man United actually try to find the right-sided midfielder. That was how bad it was. But still, somehow United find a way. Great for fans, very bad for FPL. Spurs, though, much more interesting because,
Really
as you
quickly
pointed out,
on Man United, just really quickly on that point that they are reactive and Blackstream mentioned he didn't it wasn't really a backheel. It was a touch towards the defender, so he was tackled and
trying to give credit to
I won't have it. No, undue credit. And then Comas has some information on Ramsey, but let's get to Spurs first, and then we'll go to that new Ramsey information in between the fixtures.
Yeah, I think the Richarlison's goal basically highlighted how good Pedro Porro was because I think the nice thing about that particular Richarlison goal was the in-swinger from Pedro Porro landed so well in between the two center backs. It is really a striker's dream goal, and that is pure Pedro Porro class. So it just cements Pedro Porro's status in the FPL template. But I think disappointing thing was that Richarlison did not get any chances. Like he had one 0.06 XG chance beyond that shot, beyond that goal. But that's Richarlison in a nutshell. He'll have one good moment. If he takes it, he gets a goal. But he rarely gets a brace or a hat trick. And if you want that kind of asset as your third midfielder, okay, by all means, yeah, go ahead. More interesting though is Werner, right? 6.5 million. That I think everyone's going to be talking about Werner for a little bit. Now, that assist is a little bit interesting because, well, for the first time in a very long while, Spurs have deep midfielders that can do something. The irony here is that they needed both their starting midfielders, Bissouma and Pape Matar, to be not available for Oliver Skipp and Bentancur to actually come forward and do something really good. So, I mean, it's odd. It's really odd to say that Oliver Skipp and Bentancur are going to be really threatening because of Werner in the coming weeks. It's going to be very odd to say that until Maddison comes back. But I have to give credit where credit is due. Oliver Skipp is amazing. Not as an FPL asset, but at least so long as Oliver Skipp plays, Werner will have some potential in attack. I can say that much.
Okay. I'm not gonna agree with that with you on that one. One
I've just been high
Oliver
score.
Skip, Oliver Skip is an amazing, and as Ange will pull him off the field as soon as he's able to. I mean, he does not want Oliver Skip playing because Oliver Skip is quite limited, and even Timo Werner. I mean, it's the same Darwin conversation, right? Getting in good positions, being in good situations is not enough. And until we see something different from Werner, until we see actually Spurs able to create the space that Werner needs to run into, because right now the Spurs are a little bit disjointed. I think Spurs are a little bit of an avoid until Maddison comes back. And when Maddison comes back, everything changes, including Richarlison. That one thing I think, to your point on Richarlison, you do kind of have to rely on those types of goals for now. But once he gets a better midfield behind him that can support the way he presses, I think Richarlison on the counter press becomes very dangerous and could be a really interesting asset. We'll see how that plays out. Hopefully, we don't have to see much more of Skip.
I'm not saying
but
that
you're right.
Skip
His
is creating chances. Like
no
his
no no his
progressive passing is there.
industriousness
Yeah.
his his and his industriousness keeps the ball in the right positions for Werner. And I say that thing about Werner, but I thinking Werner did what he was brought in to do in that game. So it was that was good to see. I don't think he had a poor game or anything. I just want to see some kind of evidence in front of goal first.
Yeah, no, I put my hand up. I feel awkward saying it too.
Fair enough. Okay, this one, this is I'm looking forward to this one for selfish reasons. Arsenal 5, Crystal Palace 0. Arsenal with a 3.21 XG, Palace 0.35. Arsenal obviously dominating the stats, 61% possession, 21 shots. 21 shots, only 6 shots on target, which I thought was kind of shocking. More shots off target, 8, and more blocked shots, 7, than shots on target for Arsenal. And I don't think that's a blip. I think that's a pattern for Arsenal and why Saka is not a captaincy shout. And I wrote that in the matchups thread. Arsenal had 6 big chances. 6. So like welcome back left side of the field. You have the left center back Gabriel with the goal. You have Leandro Trossard with the goal. You have Martinelli with 2 goals. I mean, that left side of the field just lit up because, well, Arteta stopped forcing his team to play on one third of the field and one half of the field. So, how did you see this one tell us like overall, and then we can get into like some of the specific picks and blast the soccer captains a little bit.
I guess you'd have to be a sucker for the template to do that. I think we have to admit, you know, there are some games where set pieces play a huge part, right, in how games go. And the fact that Arsenal took the lead through two set pieces so quickly as well, right? What, 37 minutes, they go 2-0 up. It dictates the game, right? I mean, you think about it, right? You put hindsight away and you look at Arsenal and Crystal Palace in that state, right? 40 minutes in, you are 2-0 down against Arsenal. What would Arsenal's decisions be and what would Crystal Palace's decisions be? Because at that stage, Arsenal had nothing. Like, besides the two Gabriel chances, Arsenal had absolutely nothing. So, I mean, I would really claim that Arsenal only really came to life at the stroke of halftime when Trossard did his thing. Because what we have to at least acknowledge was that Trossard played left wing and Kai Havertz played left central midfield. And this is something a little bit unusual because we're so accustomed to Trossard playing left central mid and Gabriel Martinelli playing left wing. And that, honestly, for me, is why Arsenal have been so constipated, you know, because Martinelli is basically a dead asset if scores are level. But with Arsenal 3-0 ahead after 60 minutes, when you bring Martinelli on the 69th minute, oh, Arsenal really, really come alive. And okay, so this is a point that I forgot to make during the Newcastle game, because it applies to something that Newcastle and Arsenal both have in common: playing right footers in central mid as well as on the left side. So what happens is this, right? Imagine you're a right footer and you receive the ball in central midfield. The easiest pass to make is that you literally lump it forward and the ball naturally curls to the left side. This is exactly how Newcastle used their central midfielders as well as Dan Burn to find Anthony Gordon instinctively. Bruno Guimaraes' first time pass is basically to the left flank, aiming directly at Anthony Gordon or Isak. Same thing with Arsenal here. The moment Jorginho or any of Arsenal's central midfield just receives the ball, they just hit it left and Trossard's just there on the run. Second half, Martinelli on the run. Same thing. That curled pass just needs Martinelli to make a really nice curved run to avoid the offside trap. And there you have it, right? Martinelli is like basically one-on-one with Henderson. So I think this is something that Arsenal definitely can build on in the future, because I do feel that Palace, in some sense, gave away some of the ball, right? You're 3-0 down against Arsenal. You have to go for it away from home. There's no point doing damage control at that point, right? So we do have to give Palace some sense of credit for Arsenal's and Martinelli's huge scoreline for that matter. But really, I do feel that Trossard is the real hero in all of this. But make no mistake, the left side is starting to come alive. I just feel that Trossard deserves more credit than Martinelli, because Martinelli just came on and got the two goals. But I prefer Trossard, because he has that knack of appearing in the left half space and utilizing his moments much better than Martinelli, at least, you know, in my opinion. So that's all I'd say about Arsenal.
Yeah, so I'm going to take a bit of a different view. And I saw a lot of people lauding Trossard and Gabriel Jesus. And I thought they were decent on the ball, and off the ball they were absolutely horrific, running into the wrong channels, going the wrong way. So I thought I do agree with you, like the type of player in those positions, having Trossard not on the wing or on the wing, for example, right? I do think he's better there, but I just think Arsenal are way better with Martinelli rather than Trossard. I think Martinelli brings so much more. And I wrote about this, right? That Arsenal predict, like, Roy would deal with Arsenal's right side. And if they tried to force it there, then it was going to be a kind of cagey, whatever. Arsenal should probably win. But not that I expected Arteta to finally use the left, because he hasn't basically this season. But I still, in my thread, I wrote that I'm so banking on that left-hand side. And it is that left-hand side that opens everything up for them. Both the far post runs and the runs outside of that far post, to get to Saka. And I know there's a big, I guess, controversy because a lot of people captain Saka to begin with. And here's what I would say. It's funny, because this shows kind of how content creators can drive narratives and can drive ownership as well. It was pushed by all the major content creators. It's no secret that obviously they all interact and stuff. So there's this echo chamber around it. But that drove, if you look at the Saka's effective ownership for legendary managers and for content creators, was like much higher than it was across the board. But Saka was not under consideration for captaincy for me for this week. And these are some of the reasons why. Now that the left has opened up, or if the left has now opened up, I think is a better way of putting it. We'll see. Once does not a pattern make, I think is the saying goes. Then I think Saka comes into consideration. Saka could be a better asset now. Now that if Martinelli is firing and Trossard is firing on that left-hand side and they're using that side more, now I think Saka becomes a little bit more interesting. But again, I want to see that happen again before we make any kind of determinations there. But Martinelli was always a standout pick. Nathaniel Klein was utterly exposed. Although Martinelli didn't, he was exposed against Trossard. Klein was exposed against Trossard. And then, but you know, it was his backup. I don't remember his name, but a young kid that came in for Klein. You know, he was exposed against Martinelli as well. So that Palace's right side was exposed. And Kieran Richards, I mean, the guy's not a center back. So I felt bad for him up against Gabriel in the box and stuff like that. He was always a weak point there as well. I'm curious. Arsenal have gone from a boring, constipated team for me to a team that might have an eye on, and I say that still not happy owning Saka. I'll be happy when Saka's gone from my team. Maybe even like Saka and Diaz out for KDB and Foden or something like that. Something crazy. Take some hits. All right. I think that covers this one. We can move on to the next fixture. The next fixture is Brentford 3. Forest 2, high scoring game here. Brentford only, XG was interesting. 1.2 XG for Brentford, 1.22 XG for Forest. Ball possession pretty even, shots pretty even, shots on target pretty even. Statistically speaking, this is quite an even encounter. The scoreline as well kind of says the same thing with the 3-2. I saw this game and it did not feel like a 3-2 game to me. And I just want to get in the I just want to talk about Tony one quick second. He was my captain in game week 21. And I want to talk specifically about I was super happy with the captaincy pick, even though I think that was his only shot. For some reason, it felt like he was doing the Tony things, even though he maybe wasn't around the box or the goal to do those things yet. But for those that maybe didn't see it, the ref marks the line right where the ball is, and Tony picks up the ball, right? The Turner sets the wall, right? Tony picks up the ball, moves it about 8 inches to the right, and this is the genius part right here. This is the true just master stroke. He picks up a piece of the line and redraws it around the ball to kind of extend where it looks like the ref did. And I thought, like, first of all, like, there's tons of people saying that that's cheating. If that is cheating, then running up the field a couple of yards when you're going to take a throw in is cheating, and placing the ball where the foul was, but in a different angle and a bit of a different position is cheating. Basically, any foul is cheating. It's not cheating. It's not. It's against the rules. But if you don't get cut, then you don't get cut. And Tony's job is to help his team win. And let me tell you, if you move the ball 8 inches and it goes around the wall and goes in, that's a shit wall, man. Turner gifted that goal to Tony. So I think people are upset that Tony's back and they don't have him in their team. And so they're bitching about him scoring a goal and calling him a cheat because he got busted for gambling. Like, move the fuck on is what I'm saying. And that was a sweet, clever, genius, really inventive goal. And it was another shocker by Turner, in my opinion, who's having a really rough season.
Yeah, I fully agree with the Turner criticism because as a competitive goalkeeper myself, I do organize walls to intentionally have the last man guard the post. So I will say, though, that the 8 inches make a difference. I will criticize Turner and Forrest in general for the lack of communication. I watched the entire sequence of that build-up, right? When Tony moved the ball, none of Forrest's wall was looking at Tony move the ball. That's my biggest criticism. Because if you are a man in the wall and your goalkeeper's busy organizing everyone else on the other side, the wall is supposed to react and shift over to the left themselves. Because, again, you know, as a goalkeeper, you have to utilize all the space you have. A free kick at that distance exposes a huge angle in terms of what you allow free kick takers to shoot at. So you have to literally use every inch possible to cover every angle possible of your goal. So for Turner, he intentionally blocked the near side with the wall and he himself covered the far post. And so if that wall is not set to the exact margin and if the ball is moved, the wall is supposed to move with the ball. I think that's like common sense. And I feel that the biggest culprit is the man lying down underneath the wall, because he has the best view of the free kick taker. He should be the one telling, you know, the wall, if they're not paying attention, to move across. Yeah, it should be a very common sense based thing. But I do feel that it's, you know, you have to ask yourself, right, who's the leader in Nottingham Forest? Who's the one organizing the players at the back? If it's not Turner, the leader is not obvious. I feel that ever since Forest dropped Worrell and McKenna, there has been a severe lack of leadership in that Forest side. And they're just waiting for somebody to step up. Yeah, and so Forest right now is absolute chaos.
I think Forest are a target Forest for attacking players. Nuno has made them competitive. They've played some really competitive games, but they are totally undisciplined. And I think that's kind of like what you were getting at. There's no center point that wears, there's no guide, right? There's no Sherpa on that team. And their lack of discipline, Nuno teams have lacked discipline. You know that better than most.
Yeah, I fully agree.
So I think Forest are really a team to target for attack, like against, right? They're a good matchup for attacking assets, in my opinion. All right, I think we can move on to the next one here. We're doing pretty good time here. This is the double red card game. Sheffield United 2 with a late one. West Ham 2. Sheffield United 2.5 XG. West Ham 2.34 XG. Sheffield United with the majority of possession, the majority of shots. The statistically, like, slightly better than West Ham in this one. Of course, West Ham without some key players, Kudus obviously at AFCON, pardon me, and Paqueta is injured. So, I mean, that's been 2/3 of their attack for this season. So it's understandable that West Ham may be back to their dysfunctionality in open play situation. Maybe not. I only saw the beginning of this one, then I couldn't keep watching because it was terrible. So
no, it so was.
You
was.
Talk to us.
I mean, can I lay claim to the Brereton Diaz being the competitor of Cameron Archer's? I mean, I know Diaz scored his goal in a completely different zone as Archer because he came in from the right side, but I think the lessons here, right, from this game is that, number one, Sheffield United still concede a lot of space outside their back four. right? They were exposed against Man City. They were exposed like a couple of games ago. And same thing here. If you look at the goal that West Ham, Sheffield United conceded in the first half, it was basically Danny Ings completely free between the lines, again, with Bowen distracting people. And as Danny Ings took his shot, right, you can see Maxwell Cornet on the left side, completely free and unmarked because Sheffield United's back four were basically obsessed with Bowen. So, yeah, you know, the more things change, the more things stay the same. I do feel, though, that West Ham's attack, I don't know how long this lineup will last because I don't know when Kudus and the rest are coming back. But I will say that for now, moving centrally allows Soufal to cross a lot from the right side. I know he got sent off. I don't know when he'll be back. But I do know that West Ham need crosses from wide areas in order to function. I don't think Danny Ings' output is sustainable. They exploited Sheffield United's weaknesses, but I will expect them to completely come up with the results in a completely different way next game onwards. I will say that much. But yeah, just keep Bowen. Bowen's great. He's in all the right positions and he'll get chances. Are you muted? I don't hear you. Oh my gosh. Is it me?
No, we're good. That was me. I was muted because I was typing. Sorry. I agree. Keep Bowen. It's definitely the smart thing to do. I, for one, have no interest in Bowen. I don't own him. If I did, I would want to sell him. But that's a personal thing. I totally agree with you. Let's get to the last one here before we hit the hour mark. We got about 4 minutes left in the show. Bournemouth 0 in one of their worst performances of the season. Shocking. Liverpool 4. Now, XG, Bournemouth 1.37 XG, Liverpool 1.57 XG. Obviously, Liverpool dominated the stats. This first half, so I didn't even see the end of this game, so I missed Darwin's goals, so I get to keep my bias. But this was a shit game. This was an absolute trash game of football in the first half. Luis Diaz dropping in deep to try to link play, but he's linking by receiving the ball and then just running at the back line. He's got no one to pass to because Darwin's making all the wrong runs. Jota couldn't find any space. This was a really frustrating game for me, and just like ended on a sour note. I'm glad they finally got the goals. I made the Jota call. He's one of my favorite players of the game week, and that kind of played out. But I did not enjoy this game. I thought it was really terrible.
I mean, ah, yes, it's your typical Liverpool dysfunctional thing. I mean, the moment you see Darwin play the number 9, you know that everyone else has to shift around him. That's the problem. So yes, Jota played on the right, and that is not his ideal position. Although you have to give full credit to him for finding Darwin for the first goal. I think that is class. Very unlikely from Diogo Jota that we've ever seen this season. But yes, I think we really need to talk about Bournemouth more, because Liverpool, well, you know, a lot of conversation revolves around Salah. I can't comment on how they'll play next game. But for me, just one line on Liverpool, because time is short. They just have so many rotating players, right? So Joe Gomez started at left back and he had his assist from right back for the final goal. I mean, you know, that's how much they rotate, right? Cody Agakpo came on as well, play on the right side. So Liverpool right now are basically rotating nonstop. Now, Bournemouth, we have to talk about what changes they made, because in your slides, you said that Tavernier is going to be pulled back to left back. That did not happen. They brought James Hill back from Blackburn to play left back. So Tavernier actually played right of midfield. The difference here was that they had Kluivert and Sinisterra. Oh, that was not a good move. I mean, yes, the double up was there. Sinisterra did double up with Kluivert on the left side, but there was nobody in the box to crash in and score, because Dominic Solanke likes crosses from the right, where Tavernier does that cutback and Dominic Solanke does his, you know, back side heel thing while holding off a defender. He loves that move so much, but he just didn't get to do it against Liverpool because there were barely any crosses coming in from the right side. It's a bit dysfunctional. I think Bournemouth will sort it out. I don't think Hill will see time after this. So it's just lesson learned. You know? Oh yes, and the very weird thing about Liverpool putting long balls in towards their centre backs and Bournemouth just unable to deal with it at all. That was odd. Yeah, but that's all I can say.
Yeah, I thought what one of the biggest dysfunctions for Bournemouth, and it went against like really some patterns that were really working this season, is Christie in a more advanced role. When I saw Christie in the box, he was getting in the way in people's way. His touch isn't good. He's just so much Bournemouth are so much better with Christie deeper. I did not understand these decisions by Iraola. Thought they were unnecessary and really cost and Solanke any kind of involvement or potential here. So I think Iraola really bottled this one. We'll see. He learn, you know, learn and move on kind of thing. That does it. We have Brighton hosting Wolves in a few hours here, in a couple of hours, about 2 hours here. I don't know if you'll be staying up for that one. I see you have your Wolves jersey on. So some interesting assets going there. I'm looking for Pedro, João Pedro, and I guess the two Pedros to deliver here in this one. João Pedro and Pedro Neto, looking for that kind of battle. And yeah, so enjoy that last match of the game week. I think the next deadline for game week 22 is on Saturday, but it's also a long game week or something like that. I don't know, somebody was mentioning that it was. So but yeah, thank you all. We got 21 people in the chat. Thank you for joining us. Let's see, we
Sorry
only
for
have
going over.
three. Sorry for going over a little bit. Yeah, it's okay. Long game week. We got 15 likes, so thank you so much for that as well. We will be back with the Game Week 22 matchups show on Wednesday. I don't believe teacher Lucian, you won't be joining us for that one. That one starts at 2 in the morning your time, so I think we'll let you get a little bit of sleep this week. Although I have a sneaky feeling that you'll be awake anyway and you'll join us in the chat. You usually do. Please don't. Please don't. Please stay sleeping. Thank you everyone for joining. Nice to meet you, Maddie. Thank you. Welcome to the show. Hopefully you'll join us again on Wednesday. Nice to see all of our friends here. Colm, Podna made it in as well. K7's in the house as well. Yeah, thank you all. Good luck if you have any players playing today. And if you don't, well, we will just see you on Wednesday. Peace.